Matt has indicated that Herschel has been working on a wide variety of science, and I'm going to concentrate on one particular theme which it's been making a particularly important contribution to in the last 2 to 3 years, and that's the origin of dust in the universe. We've heard quite a bit about dust, dust particles, in fact, and they're of interest because we find them everywhere. We find them in interplanetary space, we find them in interstellar space, we find them in galaxies, intergalactic space. And they basically, they recycle around the universe. They find a way into star formation regions and into planets in the making, into asteroids, and ultimately into us as well. So particles of silicates, particles of carbon, carbonaceous, and so forth. The question is, where did they originate? And how did they originate? So we see it most obviously in the optical, because we can see dark clouds in the Milky Way, where there are clouds of gas and dust, and the dust absorbs starlight. So you see this gap in the stars, which is caused by the dark cloud. This is the wavelength in the optical between 0.4 and 0.7 microns. Now, as well as absorbing radiation and scattering it, dust also re-emits the absorbed radiation. And here we see a composite picture from a Hubble image on the left, bottom left. On the bottom right, we have a Spitzer 8-micron image. Put the two together, and you can see the top composite image, optical and infrared. So in the visible, the dust is absorbing. You can see the dark lanes. And in the infrared, it's re-emitting. Now, one of the interesting and useful properties of dust is that it cannot hide from us. Gas, in many wavelength regions, can be totally transparent, and we may be unaware of its existence. But on the other hand, dust, because it's small particles, it's very efficient at absorbing and scattering radiation and also re-emitting it. So it's a very important tool for studying the distribution of gas and dust in galaxies. So we've seen this diagram a few times before. It shows the efficiency with which radiation is emitted by bodies at different temperatures. So on the top left, you see the 10,000-degree body, which peaks in the visible. The yellow one is the temperature of the sun, 5,770 degrees K. And as we go down 1,000 K, we put into the infrared. 300 K is the temperature of the surface of the Earth and of us, approximately, where our radiation is peaking at 10 microns wavelength, 20 times the visible region. And if you go yet further, 100 K, you're peaking out at 50. You go down to 10 K, you're well into the submillimeter region. Now, I said that dust can't hide, but it can try its best to hide by getting very cold, because the colder the material gets, the less efficiently it emits. You can see here that each hotter black body is always emitting more at any given wavelength than the cooler one. Even though the cool one peaks at a longer wavelength, it emits less per unit area at every wavelength than the hotter black bodies. So we have a situation where very cold material is very inefficient. And if we're going to detect it, we need very sensitive detectors. And that's where Herschel comes in. Herschel has been opening a window and revealing properties of material that we've not been able to study before because it emits so inefficiently, in particular the dust particles, which we often see. So here's another version of the diagram that Matt showed. On the top left, we see the Hubble Deep Field, which was a heroic observation worth several hundred of hours of integration by the Hubble Space Telescope in the optical, showing also a scuba field done with 51 hours of integration time. And there shown were the area on the moon that they would subtend, a tiny area of the moon's surface. And on the right, we have the Hubble Atlas 16-hour integration, which, as Matt says, has about 7,500 galaxies. Within each of those dots is a dust-emitting galaxy. One of the surprises that SCUBA revealed about 15 years ago was that even at high redshifts, we're seeing a lot of dust. As I'll show, our picture in the past and until recently was that it was low and intermediate mass stars like the Sun, which were making these dust particles when they became red giants. And they take quite a long time to become red giants. So we thought that dust was growing and growing in galaxies as they got older and older. So the Milky Way today had much more dust than in the past. But as we'll see, our ideas on this are being overturned by missions like Spitzer and Herschel. So here's two more deep fields. The Atlas deep field was in Ursa Major. The field on the left is in Buta. It's another area well above the galactic plane, where you have little foreground dust emission from our own Milky Way. So there's little confusion. And on the right, we have another four-degree field, which is in the Lockman Hole, which was shown, I think, in Michael's talk, as one of those areas well away from the galactic plane with little foreground dust. So it's an ideal area to do deep integrations to find galaxies. And each of these has tens of thousands of galaxies in the field, all full of dust, and many of them going out to quite high redshifts when the universe was young. So just to briefly acquaint you with properties of dust, they are very small particles, typically less than 0.2 of a micron in diameter in the interstellar medium. They may occur in these filamentary structures where you get macroscopic properties by the overall size of the filament, but the microscopic properties of the individual pebbles, you might say, are what dominates in the optical and infrared. And we think these dust particles, as I mentioned in the past, we thought red giant stars on the left there were making the copious amounts of dust at the very end of the evolution of the star, but just before it becomes a white dwarf. We also suspected that supernovae, these are the explosions of massive stars, say 8-9 solar masses and above, we suspected that they made dust particles, but we had very little information on that because most of the supernovae we see are at great distances in external galaxies. And with few exceptions, we haven't had any close at hand where we could actually find out whether they're making dust. So these objects can inject dust into the interstellar medium. The dust finds its way into interstellar dark clouds, such as we saw in the first slide. And out of these clouds, stars collapse and form planets. And you end up with solar systems with the dust coalescing into planetesimals and ultimately planets. So just to, we have some proof that it's not all speculation, that dust particles do actually get made in red giant stars, because on this diagram, it shows isotopic ratios, carbon-12 to carbon-13 on the bottom versus nitrogen-14 to nitrogen-15 on the left. And the sun is the intersection, the solar abundance is the intersection of the two dotted lines, and any deviating from that, I've got non-solar abundance ratios. You can do this for other isotopes of other elements as well. And they diagnose, on the bottom right, we've got isotopic ratios, which we know are characteristic of the processes that happen in supernovae. So we think the dust particle inclusions that we find in meteorites ultimately came from supernovae. On the top left, there are inclusions which are characteristic of red giant isotopic ratios. So we think those dust particles came from red giants. They only account for 5% of all the material. Most of the rest of it got homogenized, heated up, and came out with this average abundance which the solar system now has. Now, red giant stars, this is an example of one of the closest of all. In fact, I think it is the closest, IRC plus 10216, also known as CW LEO. This was found in the 2-micron sky survey, which Michael mentioned, Leighton and Neugebauer. It was one of the earliest discoveries. It's totally invisible at optical wavelength. This is a deep ESO VLT image taken with several hours of integration in the visible. And all you can see here are rings of reflection from the dust that's been emitted by the star. Now, that sort of peanut-shaped object you can see in the middle is not the star. It's a reflection nebula around the star. We can't see the star directly in the optical. We go to the infrared, it becomes more transparent. We can see it. We also see the dust emission that we're seeing here in reflection. So this one is 10,000 times more luminous than the sun, and it's the brightest source in the sky at 5-micron wavelength. So 10 times longer than visible, this becomes the brightest source in the sky. We can't see it at all in the visible. Here's an image taken with the GALAX ultraviolet explorer, an orbiting explorer put up by NASA. Here we're seeing a bow shock around CW LEO, the star. And on the left, you have near UV plus far UV, and on the right, the far UV only. Stars in the middle. The bow shock is being illuminated by interstellar starlight, which is reflected by dust in the bow shock. So what would we expect if we go to the infrared with Herschel? we would expect to see the dust in emission. And this is faintly what we see. You can see the star in the middle, and on the left, a faint arc of emission, which is coming from that same dust that we saw in reflection in the ultraviolet. On the left, we have a PAX 160 micron image. On the right, we have a Spire 250 micron image. Those dots in the Spire image are background galaxies that are showing up in large numbers. In fact, if you go to the previous slide again, two back, you can see galaxies all around it. It's so faint in the optical that we can see the background galaxies at those wavelengths. So, going to more massive stars now, and I'll go right up to the most massive star we know in the Milky Way, which is called Eta Carinae. It's 2,300 parsecs away from us, 7,500 light years. It was subject to a giant optical outburst in 1848, which was studied by Sir John Herschel, the son of William Herschel, from South Africa, where he spent 5 years surveying the southern skies. This outburst went on until the 1890s. It became the second brightest star in the sky. Normally it's sixth magnitude today, sixth or seventh, but it got as bright as -1, I think, in 1848. So, and then it faded again. And the reason it faded was because the dust that was created in the explosion gradually began to obscure it. So we're seeing it now through a mass of dust. So that is largely, we're seeing in that Hubble Space Telescope image, reflection nebula from the dust and also optical line emission in that image due to shocked gas. So the ejected material from this star was 0.4 solar masses, and the total amount of mass ejected in the 19th century was 10 solar masses, which is a substantial fraction of the estimated mass of the star, 150 solar masses. Now, the fate of this star is to become a supernova, but we don't know when. This is a Herschel image with composite of PAX and Spire wavelengths. So Eta Carinae is in the middle with the arrow pointing towards it. The colors indicate blue and purple are the hottest dust, or the warmest, I should say, because it's not hot. And as we go out to further and further away from the heat source in the center, then the dust gets cooler. So we see red emission around the edges, which is the coolest dust. Right, so those are the wavelengths, 70, 160, and 250 microns that went into making that. And ringed at the top is another massive star cluster. But Eta Carinae is the one of interest because it's going to explode one day soon. Now, when a supernova explodes, just before it explodes, this is the internal structure of the star. On the very outermost regions, you have hydrogen, which is what it formed out of. But you have an onion skin structure as successive stages of nuclear fusion have progressed through the star. The star supports itself against gravity by burning nuclear fuel. First of all, hydrogen, then helium, and so on. But once it gets to nickel and iron, it can't go any further. That's the limit for nuclear fusion. So at that point, it can't support itself anymore. The star collapses and then explodes. And it spews all these materials that it's created into interstellar space. As it expands, it cools, and you get condensation of molecules and then dust particles. So the theory was quite definite that it should be creating dust particles, but we had very little information about how it did it. Now, just recapping now, recent surveys of nearby galaxies have indicated that there may not be enough dust made by these red giant sources that we talked about. In fact, it looks like we've got to appeal to supernovae to provide at least 50% and maybe more of the dust we find in galaxies. But in addition, we've got further evidence of the importance of supernovae. Here again is that SCUBA sources in four different fields. We find that even at high redshifts, greater than 6, when the universe was less than a billion years old, these galaxies are full of dust, and some of them, redshifts greater than 6, have 100 million solar masses of dust. That's just the dust. Multiply that by 100 to get the gas masses, and they're forming stars at a rapid rate. The calculation was done, how much dust would we need per supernova? And the answer came out as between a tenth and one solar mass, depending on how efficiently you destroy the dust in the galaxies. If you're inefficient at destroying it, you only need a tenth. If you're very efficient at destroying it through its lifetime, then you may need a solar mass of dust. So the question is, can our observations confirm or not that supernovae can make dust at this rate? Well, in 1987, February 23rd, a supernova in 1987A was discovered. It's in the Large Magellanic Cloud, a satellite galaxy of our own in the southern hemisphere. And it was a major event. It got brighter than 6th magnitude, even though it was 160,000 light years away. And during the second year after the outburst, it began to condense dust, as indicated on the right by that curve coming from 400-degree K dust. That was just the temperature at which modelers had predicted the dust should form. As it got cooler, you should start to condense the molecules into dust particles. And so that was bang on. The problem, though, was that the mass of dust that was derived was only 1/1000th of a solar mass, and that's nowhere near large enough to explain what we need in galaxies today and in galaxies in the past. When Spitzer was launched, it was able to observe many more supernovae in the local universe, out to maybe 15 megaparsecs. And here's an example of one such a supernova event. Top left, about a year after outburst, it had got quite bright in the mid-infrared, as seen by Spitzer. 6 months later, it had faded below detection limits, as expected. So the dust cools and expands and gets cooler and cooler. But again, the problem was that the mass of dust was only about 1/1000th of a solar mass that we were seeing. So it was doing it on time, it was doing it at the right temperature, but it didn't seem to be making enough dust mass. So this takes us on to the contribution of the Herschel Space Observatory. And in particular, it had one sub-program, which was looking at galactic supernova remnants. Those are in their own Milky Way. And these are historical supernova remnants that have occurred in the last 1,000 years. We pick these because the mass of interstellar gas that you'll swept up will be very low, so you won't be contaminated by swept up material. So the four supernovae descending edge, or increasing edge downwards, Cass A was dates from about 1680. Kepler, 1604, discovered by the astronomer Kepler, of course, who was a student of Tycho, who had discovered the remnant in 1572. And then the Crab Nebula, which was seen by Chinese and Japanese astronomers in 1054. Now, the Cass A and the Crab are type 2 supernovae, coming from massive stars, whereas Kepler and Tycho came from type 1A, which come from low-mass stars, as I'll show in a minute. So on the bottom left, we've got Crab, then we have Cass A, then we have Kepler, sorry, we have Tycho, sorry, Kepler and Tycho. That's it. Now I'm going to go quickly through the type 1As, which are not that relevant to our discussion, but they're major supernova remnants, and they tell us something about low-mass stars. Type 1As are produced by binary systems containing a white dwarf and another low-mass star, which dumps matter on the white dwarf. Eventually, the white dwarf explodes when it exceeds what's called the Chandrasekhar limit, goes over 1.4 solar masses, and they're predicted to make over half a solar mass of iron atoms. In fact, they are the major sources of iron in our galaxy and on Earth. So here we see at X-ray, visible in infrared wavelengths, Kepler and Tycho. And here are the Herschel images. On the left, we have the PAX images at 3 PAX wavelengths. On the right, we have the Spire longer wavelength images. We can see the remnant of Kepler in the PAX images, and that's fairly warm dust by 80 degrees K, and the mass is only 3 by 10 to the minus 3, 3/1000th of a solar mass. On the right, all we see is foreground interstellar dust emission, cool material in front of and behind the remnant. We don't see any cold dust emission from the supernova. And so looking at the edge, the dust emission is coincident with what was previously known at X-ray wavelengths. This is gas and dust, which is swept up from previously ejected circumstellar material that was put there before this star exploded. If we look in the middle, there's no dust emission at all. So somehow it's avoided making dust. Here's Tycho, same story. So here at PAX wavelengths, you see this blue emission, which is the warm dust, at about 90 degrees K, about 1/100th of a solar mass. Again, it turns out to be interstellar material, because this top left image shows optical emission from H-alpha recombination lines of hydrogen. The right is the dust emission, and they're absolutely coincident. and they're believed to be swept up interstellar. A small amount of swept up interstellar gas. Again, nothing in the middle of the, no dust emission in the middle. So the absence of dust particles is a bit of a surprise because it implies that their iron atoms have failed to condense into particles. You'd expect iron to easily condense into dust particles, but they haven't done it. This isn't a setback for our models of dust in the galaxy. We have to turn to massive stars and their supernovae. So here's Cassiopeia A, believed to have exploded by 1680. The expansion age points to an age of about 1670, 76. But John Flamsteed, the Astronomer Royal at the time, catalogued about 6,000 bright stars in the northern sky. One of them he labelled as 3 Cassiopeia and was never found again by astronomers. And some people have suggested that this was the supernova. The reason it was so faint is because there's a huge amount of interstellar dust between us and this remnant, which makes it virtually invisible at optical wavelengths. But it, in a peak outburst, it might have just shone through to be visible to the human eye. So here are the Herschel images at 6 wavelengths. The top 3 are the PACs, 70, 100, and 160, and the bottom 3, 250, 350, 500. Now you can see the remnant easily in the top left at 70 microns. You can still see it at 100. At 160, interstellar dust emission is beginning to dominate, and you just completely dominate, except you get to 500 microns. You can just see the remnant peeking out of the top, the northern part of the remnant. And that, in fact, is non-thermal emission by high-energy electrons spiraling around magnetic fields. That dominates. It's very bright at radio wavelengths, and it's declining as you go into the infrared, but it's still bright enough at 500 microns to see it. So here, top left and middle left are 2 images, radio at 6 centimeters and Spitzer image at 3.6 microns, both dominated by synchrotron emission from those fast electrons. The bottom 3 are the interstellar dust emission. To get to what the dust in the remnant is doing, you've got to remove the synchrotron emission and the foreground interstellar dust emission. And we're able to interpolate between the infrared and the radio at all wavelengths and subtract out that emission. Similarly, we can extrapolate to shorter wavelengths the interstellar dust emission and get left with what we think is just the emission inside the remnant. So the top middle is a 24 micron seen by Spitzer, and the 70 micron image has got similarities to that, but it also has some material inside. Once you subtract extrapolated warm dust emission from 24 microns, you're left with that middle right image. And the untouched 100 micron image without any, you don't need to extrapolate the 24 micron for it. It looks very similar, and you can see there's dust emission right in the middle of the remnant. So the outer parts of the remnant has a forward shock. The inner part is a ring of called reverse shock, and the dust is on the reverse shock and inside it. So it is new dust emission made by the remnant. And we've been able to fit the energy distributions and estimate the mass of dust. Herschel sees 0.075 solar masses of cool 35-degree K dust. And allowing for the warmer dust seen by Spitzer at 24 microns, that's another 0.025, you get a total dust mass of a tenth of a solar mass, which is getting close to being what we need to explain dust in galaxies. And that 33,000 Earth masses is made in one go. So probably the most famous supernova remnant is the Crab Nebula in Taurus, Messier 1, in Messier's catalogue. Exploded in 1054 and a distance of about 6,500 light years. This is a Hubble composite image at multiple optical wavelengths. When we go to the infrared with Herschel, the bottom left shows 70 microns, the bottom right is 100 microns. Now, one of the characteristics of telescopes as you go to longer and longer wavelengths is your angular resolution scales with your wavelength. So the shorter the wavelength, the better your angular resolution. The longer it is, the lower your angular resolution. This is why the images look more blurred as you go to longer wavelengths. But you can see 70 microns gives us our best resolution, and you can see it has great similarities to the optical image. There's lots of knots and filaments, and it's in those knots and filaments that the dust is located. And yet again, this remnant has made dust. So here's a spectral, as we call it, a spectral energy distribution from 1 micron to 100,000 microns, which is 1 centimeter radio wavelengths. And what you see here, the blue points come from the Planck satellite. Turns out the Crab Nebula is one of their calibrators, so we have very good signal-to-noise at longer wavelengths. We have overlap with Herschel at the 500 micron point. They agree perfectly. And then we have the six Herschel points, which show you the peak of the dust emission. The black points on the left come from Spitzer, and we can interpolate the non-thermal emission from the radio and Planck through to the Spitzer and subtract it. And then we get a fit with two dust emissions, one at 63 degrees K and the other at 34 K. Subtract all those fits, and the residuals are showing on the bottom. And the total mass, again, is between a tenth and a quarter of a solar mass. So again, right in the ballpark we need to emit to explain dust in galaxies. So just to complete this, I'll mention our supernova 87A again. This, as I mentioned, went off on February 23rd, 87. We're now into the 26th year after outburst. It was found to make this warm dust after about 2 to 3 years. And the question was, what would Herschel find? This is on the bottom right. Well, the top left shows the entire Large Magellanic Cloud as mapped by the Heritage Key Project of Herschel. And when they were examining the images in detail, they found that there was a source exactly coincident with supernova 1987A. Very cool source. And in the next slide, the top right shows the energy distributions. Now, on the left, we have material emitting, and it turns out to be in that bright ring of material around supernova 87A. We know that came from the star before it exploded. It was emitted by the star when it was a supergiant. And it's being lit up now by the outer reaches of the remnant beginning to hit it. Now, in the middle of that remnant, you can see this ghostly emission. Well, that is the ejector that was ejected by the supernova 25 years ago. This was an image in 2005, so that was 18 years after outburst. It's continued to expand since. Spitzer was able to resolve the ring emission, and the curve you see on the left is from the ring. The new emission that we're seeing with Herschel is much colder, and we believe it's coming from the material in the middle, the ejector itself. And we can fit this material with a composite of amorphous carbon, silicate, and iron. So another diagram showing this. What they found was that you can't expand it with a single species. If you try to fit it with silicate, you would exceed the amount of silicon that the supernova could create. Try to fit it just with carbon, you exceed the amount of carbon that it create, and the same for iron. But you can fit it by adding all three of those components without violating the cosmic abundance constraints, the amount of material that supernova actually made. And when you do that, you find the total mass is 0.7 solar masses. So that's a very high mass indeed, 230,000 Earth masses made by 87A. So just to summarize, Herschel has uncovered more than a tenth of a solar mass of cool dust, each of the three young massive star supernovae that it has observed. So the implication appears to be that core collapse supernovae may be able to account for these huge masses of dust found in very young, luminous, high redshift galaxies. I think the future now is for observatories like ALMA in the Atacama to now observe this at very high angular resolution. Over the ensuing years from now, we're going to see the ejector hit the ring, and we'll see massive shocks happening. We may see some of the dust being destroyed by the shocks. So it'll be astrophysics in real time. Okay, thank you.